choreography.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim, very much. It's a real pleasure to be back in the United States and a pleasure to be back at the Philadelphia Society. I tire, as most of us do, of getting beaten up by left-wing fanatics out there, and it's always good to come home so we can be beaten up by right-wing fanatics. But somehow your punches mean more to me than the others do, and it's good to be with you. When Bill Campbell asked if I could participate, I was thrilled to be able to say yes, and told him that what I wanted to do was something slightly different and probably outrageous to the Philadelphia Society. And that was, rather than take the high road of American constitutionalism, I would like to take what many conservatives would consider to be the low road. And I'd like to talk this morning about Thomas Hobbes and his foundational importance to American constitutionalism, to the way law is understood in this country, because I think he has been misunderstood greatly through the years by virtually both sides in the debate. If my old friend Ellis Sandoz is here, I will apologize for him in advance, because the grinding noise you hear will be Ellis's teeth as I get into this. We exchanged a few remarks years ago in the National Review, and these remarks today will not be dissimilar to those. Thomas Hobbes was born in 1588, prematurely, legend has it, due to his mother's anxiety over the Armada. A century later, England was shaken to its roots and exulted in the political implications of the Glorious Revolution. Between those two seemingly disparate events, modern constitutionalism was born. And it was, I contend, the so-called monster of Malmesbury who had planted the seeds of that juridical revolution, and an upheaval of tradition that would far exceed the tumultuous political events of his own 17th century England. Hobbes has been called by Sir William Holdsworth the greatest and certainly the most original and stimulating philosopher that England ever produced. Yet he was doomed to be reviled in his own time and in his own land and for centuries to come. His name was, as John Locke said, and was forced to say, was justly decried. And some of that time even accused Hobbes' writings of being the cause of divine retribution that came in the form of both the plague and the Great Fire of London. This is called bad PR. And in the last public book burning at Oxford, both the Kive and Leviathan were deemed good fuel for the scholarly flames of intolerance. In spite of the reaction of the English lawyers and professors and priests, the foundation of whose power and influence he attacked with all his might, Hobbes' influence took root not in his homeland, but in that near primitive land across the sea, America. As far as MacDonald has rightly noted, the thinking of Hobbes penetrated the minds of Americans more pervasively than Americans knew, and would have found it politic to admit. In America, filtered as his views often were through other less noxious writers such as Pufendorf, Battelle, Burlamaqui, Rutherford, Blackstone, Locke, and Trenchard and Gordon, Hobbes' views found their audience. Determined to prove that men could indeed establish government, good government from reflection and choice, and not be forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force, the Americans took their bearings from the political philosophy of natural rights constitutionalism that Hobbes had articulated. As John Jay said in The Federalist, echoing Hobbes, "Nothing is more certain than the indispensable necessity of government, and it is equally undeniable that whenever and however it is instituted, the people must cede to it some of their natural rights in order to vest it with requisite powers." To a far greater degree than his successor, Locke, Hobbes was explicitly concerned with the nature and extent of law. In all of his great works, including his translation of Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, Hobbes' political attention was drawn to the role to be played by law in any healthy regime. From the elements of law to Leviathan to Behemoth, he sought to explore and explain how law served as the border between politics and philosophy. Even though deeply interested in law, Hobbes was not a legal theorist as such. His interest in law was more philosophical than practical, more concerned with political sovereignty than judicial doctrine. "My design," he confessed, "is not to show what is law here and there, but what is law." Nor was Hobbes a well-read scholar of the law. The references in his works to legal texts and thinkers are few, and some have suggested that the grasp of those he does cite is not all that strong. As a general matter, Hobbes didn't surround himself with books. He didn't feel the need to. In law, as in other areas, his view is always, as he told his friend John Aubrey, that if he had read as much as other men, he would have known no more than other men. What he had to say, he believed, did not depend on the authority of others. The most troubling aspect of Hobbes's thought for those who would seek the sources of liberal constitutionalism is his well-known assertion that the sovereign is not bound by the civil laws. Most often this is taken as proof that Hobbes's true purpose was a defense of absolute monarchy. But given his repeated insistence that the sovereign need not be a monarch, It might even be a democracy or an aristocracy, he said. There's another way of understanding what he means when he said the sovereign is above the law. His argument, in fact, I believe, is the first sustained effort to fashion a conception of fundamental law that is distinct from and superior to ordinary civil law, yet does not depend upon the medieval belief in higher natural or divine law. Hobbes's sovereign has more in common with the Constitution based on popular sovereignty than with any notion of institutional absolutism. Hobbes's problem with medieval scholasticism and that tradition of higher or divine law was not with God, but with those who presumed to speak for God. He vigorously attacked the priests, professors, and lawyers of his day, those whom he called the insufferable gown men at Oxford and Cambridge, those unrelentingly crafty and ambitious schoolmen, as he derided them, and those, in his word, and this is why I love Hobbes, because he rises to rhetorical elegance, blockheads whose vain and erroneous philosophy had plunged mankind into a veritable kingdom of darkness ruled by a confederacy of deceivers. Good government, Hobbes believed, depended upon the destruction of this, what he called an aristocracy of orators. Hobbes's bold project was to supplant the traditional conception of fundamental law as deriving from God, nature, or custom with a startling new notion. In his view, fundamental law is created by a shrewd and rational calculation, not discovered through right reason, because in his simple formulation, right reason is non-existent. The fundamental law that results from what Hobbes called sovereignty by institution is that, he said, which being taken away, the commonwealth faileth and is utterly dissolved, as a building whose foundation is destroyed. In more modern terms, the law that is fundamental for Hobbes is analogous to a constitution. The original agreement that determines what form a commonwealth will take, decides whether the sovereign will be a monarchy, an aristocracy, or even a democracy, and establishes and defines the power of the sovereign. What institutional form the sovereign power might take was a matter of some indifference to Hobbes. The power of sovereignty is the same in whomsoever it be placed. What mattered most to Hobbes was that sovereignty be absolute, however it be institutionally manifested, and that it be limited to the purposes for which, as he put it, it was trusted with the sovereign power, namely the procuration of the safety of the people. This new understanding of sovereignty and fundamental law led Hobbes logically to the necessity of written law, for the essence of all laws is that they must be, he said, made known to every man who shall be obliged to obey them. Although he was willing to concede such promulgation may be made by some other act, the most likely means, in fact the only means he ever explicitly defends, is that the law be written and published. This was no less true for the fundamental law than for the civil laws. Hobbes knew, as he put it, that the bonds of words are too weak to bridle men's ambition, avarice, anger, and other passions, without the fear of some coercive power. Ultimately, laws had to be made to hold, he argued, by the danger, though not by the difficulty, of breaking them. This was to be achieved by the ominous shadow cast by the public sword, with which the people themselves would arm their sovereign. For in Hobbes's view, covenants without the sword are but words and have no strength to secure a man at all. Still, the sword without the words of the law would be at odds with Hobbes's theory of the social contract, a contract that was not meant to bind men down to service to an unrestrained and independent power. Hobbes never lost sight of the principle most basic to his constitutional thought, that the sovereign exists only for the good of the people, and the good of the sovereign and the people cannot be separated. The law made by the sovereign can never be the result of a will independent of the people, for the will of the sovereign is nothing other than the reduction of all wills of the multitude of the people by a plurality of voices into one will. The end of the law for Hobbes is not to make men good by the imposition of a superior will independent of the society, but to leave them free. And this he seeks to do by allowing them to follow their own wills expressed by their sovereign as civil law. The use of the law, he argued, is not to bind people from all voluntary actions, but to direct and keep them in such a motion as not to hurt themselves by their own impetuous desires, rashness, or indiscretion. As hedges are set, he said, not to stop the travelers, but to keep them in their way. To assure the certainty in the law that distinguishes Hobbes' civil society from the terrifying arbitrariness of his state of nature, it is necessary, above all, he argued, that laws promulgated by the sovereign avoid as much as possible the confusion and ambiguity that inevitably attend any written law. This can be achieved by making clear in each law the causes and the motives for which it was made. But the problem is that all words are subject to ambiguity. As a result, he argued, all laws have need of interpretation. Hobbes knew that judges, created by and subordinate to the sovereign, would be called upon to resolve disputed meanings. The problem for Hobbes's commonwealth is precisely what led him to seek to supplant the scholastic legal tradition. What is the proper basis of a true or authentic interpretation of the laws? One weak and false principle, as Hobbes put it, that he banished from the outset was a notion that we find all too intoxicating today, that men shall judge what is lawful and unlawful, not by the law itself, but by their own consciences. That is to say, by their own private judgments. Law, said Hobbes, does not depend upon the wisdom of subordinate judges, but the reason of this, our artificial man, the commonwealth, and his command that maketh law. Whatever ambiguity may be in words generally, there was one thing about which Hobbes's theory of sovereignty left no doubt. There is, he said, only one sense of the law. Hobbes understood well the function of a judge called upon to interpret the law was only to give effect to the original intention of the lawmaker. And I have a lengthy comment by Hobbes that I will read to you. For it is not the letter, but the intendment or meaning, that is to say, the authentic interpretation of the law, which is the sense of the legislator, in which the nature of the law consisteth. And therefore the interpretation of all laws dependeth upon the authority sovereign. And the interpreters can be none but those which the sovereign shall appoint. For else, by the craft of an interpreter, the law may be made to bear a sense contrary to that of the sovereign, by which means the interpreter becomes the legislator. Although a judge may err in interpretation of the written law, as Hobbes said, there is no way that such an error of a subordinate judge can change the law. The only true or authentic interpretation is one that exposes and gives effect to the meaning the legislator intended. Should a judge disregard the reason which moved the sovereign to make such law, in order to do what the judge thinks right according to his conscience, he thereby supplants the public judgment of the sovereign with his own private judgment, and that, Hobbes unambiguously decreed, would be, in his word, unjust. Through additions and embellishments of such writers as Locke, Trenchard, and Gordon, and the authors of The Federalist, Hobbes's notion of sovereignty by institution came to be given expression in the idea of a written and ratified constitution that rested upon the sovereignty of the people. It was for this reason that Alexander Hamilton could defend the power of the judiciary to declare void any law that conflicted with the Constitution. The judges would be guided, Hamilton said, by the intention of the people, rather than by the mere intention of their agents. And it was precisely this notion of constitutionalism that led Chief Justice John Marshall 200 years ago in Marbury against Madison to proclaim a written constitution to be the greatest improvement on political institutions. The history of the United States, of course, is a history defined in part by judges who refused to abide by such wisdom. We have pantheons of second-rate judges doing third-rate things. Harry Blackman comes to mind, but one shouldn't speak ill of the dead. There is no doubt that in all too many cases, judges and justices have been more than willing to supplant the original intention of the people, the sovereign people, with their own private notions of morality. Such a judicial willingness to seek justice is a danger to republican government and individual liberty. And no one has ever captured this problem more powerfully, I believe, than did Justice Benjamin Curtis in his dissent in the case of Dred Scott against Sanford. As Curtis said, when a strict interpretation of the Constitution, according to the fixed rules which govern the interpretation of the laws, is abandoned, and the theoretical opinions of individuals are allowed to control its meaning, we have no longer a Constitution. We are under the government of individual men who, for the time being, have the power to declare what the Constitution is according to their own views of what it ought to mean. The strongest arguments against such a dangerous view of judicial power are, I believe, to be found in Hobbes and the theory of constitutional thinking that he spawned. The founders were concerned early on with finding written constitutions that would secure forevermore the fundamental law. They sought to find documents that could be written and ratified that would, in the words of one, survive the rude storms of time. It is, I believe, in Hobbes's theory that we find those protections for those rude storms of time. Thank you.